You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for the Holy Crowley Hour.
Okay, boys and girls, let's go! Ow. We're all right. Another wretched morning, a wretched October day. No sound of angels in the trees, Christmas.
Good evening, and welcome to the special Thanksgiving edition of the Holy Crowley Hour, the only holiday radio show offering a vegan menu. No actual entrees, just the menu itself, which is entirely plant-based. For those of you of the carnivore persuasion, you might be asking yourself, what is the Holy Crowley Hour? Well, sometime several years ago, a KBOO talk show caller made an accusation. She claimed there were several late-night DJs at the station who belonged to an Aleister Crowley cult. Aleister Crowley, for those of you who don't know, was a remarkable Englishman who lived from 1875 to 1947. He founded the religion of Thelema and styled himself a prophet, leading humanity into a new age of self-realization. He was also accused by some of being a Satanist, and the press at the time denounced him as the wickedest man in the world. Of course, now there's a whole lot more competition than there was then. Back to that KBOO caller. In her defense, she was partly right. Many of our late-night DJs, myself included, are members of a cult, and this cult is led by a Crowley. However, it's not the cult led by Aleister Crowley. Rather, it's the one led by his brother Carl, Carl Crowley. Carl is Aleister's little-known brother, and that's just the way he wants it. You're probably wondering by now, is there any difference between the two Crowley cults? Yes, there are some major differences. For instance, Aleister Crowley's cult has but one commandment, do what thou wilt. Carl Crowley's cult also has but one commandment, do what I tell you. And that's the commandment we follow here on the Holy Crowley Hour. Whatever Carl tells me to say and play on the show, that's what I say and play. I do what I'm told and have no voice in what you're about to hear. The programming is under Carl's complete control. However, I will say it's fortunate for you, the listener, that Carl Crowley has impeccable taste. I'll be playing radio, theater, podcasts, comedy, novelty bits, and a few tunes guaranteed to entertain and enlighten, which is a whole lot better than I can say for some cults that have absolutely no sense of taste, like the cult that's home to the minority members on the House Intelligence Committee. If I were a member of that cult, I'd be shouting and insulting you, attempting to destroy your reputation and good name while spouting the most ridiculous conspiracy theories without even the slightest shred of logic or evidence. Come to think of it, isn't that what the Thanksgiving holiday is really all about? You're listening to the Holy Crowley Hour, the radio show that puts the pro in quid pro quo. Our guests tonight are Caitlin Statz and Travis Vancroft of Fool and Scholar Productions. Caitlin and Travis create audio dramas, what they call adventure in your headphones. Their work includes The White Vault, Dark Dice, Fast Horizon, and Liberty. The writing, acting, and production are absolutely stellar. And perhaps more than any other podcast creators I know, they go to great lengths in getting the voices, effects, and music as authentic as possible. If you haven't heard their work, you're in for a treat. We'll be playing the very first episode from their White Vault podcast in its entirety after our conversation. Caitlin and Travis, thanks for making that trek across town to KBOO for the Holy Crowley Hour.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Now, I'd first like to give listeners a little on each of your backgrounds and how you came to audio drama podcasting. Caitlin, you were a grad student in Florida doing research and lab work. What was your field of study? Was it cartography or?
So I wasn't a grad student in Florida. I was actually a graduate student over in England.
I'm going to fire my research intern.
Okay. So I actually went to the University of Oxford, and I was studying archaeological sciences So my job isn't the, or my job wasn't supposed to be like the Indiana Jones character. It was more like the character that an archaeologist would send the samples to, who sits in a white sterile lab and runs them through mass spectrometry. And my specialization was in tephrochronology, which was the study of volcanic glass to help us tell time or tell a timeline.
It seems like a perfect background then for, I could see where a lot of that would be influential for the White Vault in particular.
Yeah, I love including the knowledge that I have, and it really helps that I enjoy research. I enjoy spending a lot of time looking up every scientific article I can find about the archaeology of an area and incorporating that into the story. So it helps with the authenticity, and it also helps make it really fun for me as a creator.
Now, that was, of course, one influence. The other is your love of the horror genre.
Yes.
What attracts you to horror, and what kind of movies, books are you a fan of?
So what attracts me to horror is that when you're scared of something, you're not thinking of anything else. When you sit down to watch a scary movie, you're sitting down to forget the world around you and be terrified by something. And that's a huge relief for a lot of people. It might seem like, oh, why would you want to be scared? And I was like, I'd rather be scared about something like the swamp creature or something like the White Vault than be scared about the things that are actually going on in real life. Because it's a vacation from the terrible parts of real life. And instead you get thrown into a zombie or a horror movie of some kind. So I enjoy that horror is an escapist place. And then as far as the actual reading goes, I have always, ever since I discovered Lovecraft's work, I've enjoyed his work. I also found M.R. James, who was one of the people that Lovecraft also enjoyed. So I kind of traced that back. And then I think the one after him going back further was Le Guin. And I just keep...
Oh, that's not Ursula Le Guin, is it?
No. This is an Irish writer.
Wow, that's somebody I haven't heard of. He was very big in the horror genre at the time?
So he wrote Victorian era horror. And he wrote one, short stories. One of them is called Green Tea. And I can't think of his name off the top of my head right now. I'm so sorry. But
I'll look it up. I'll put that in the notes in the episode.
Good. It'll make it sound like we know. But I enjoy more the existential feeling that people get from horror. I'm not so much into gore horror or jump scares. I feel like if horror can make you think about it later on and you really can settle in and have the ideas later when you're drinking coffee and you're finally understanding what happened or it hits you, that's what I really enjoy.
And I know you've said previously, because I have listened to some of your past interviews, that it's not just the terrifying aspect of being afraid. You like horror that informs and educates as well, which you certainly do in The White Vault.
Yes. We use our stories not only to tell a scary story, but to tell stories about things like climate change or things like stories about the people who live in an area. Or one of our spinoffs for The White Vault, we use it to showcase a language that rarely ever gets to be showcased because it's a nearly extinct language. So we like to use our ability to create these enthralling fictional stories as a way to also introduce people to new ideas they might have not heard of before or information that isn't readily available and other things like that.
Now, you started not with podcasts in doing horror, but you actually wrote some short stories, and I think you published in a sci-fi anthology a few of those. I really got to fire that research intern.
So I didn't start writing horror. So what maybe...
Were they sci-fi stories then?
They were sci-fi stories.
Oh, okay.
But they were sci-fi stories for podcasts. So I started writing with Liberty. That was the very first thing that I ever wrote. And Travis and I actually wrote that together. And we very quickly found out that I was a much better writer and he was an amazing sound designer. So we decided maybe writing together wasn't the best idea, but writing and then having him produce was the best idea. So I started writing when I was still at university, and I just wrote to fill the time because I really needed to express some kind of creativity that I wasn't getting to express when I was doing my courses. And we created our first adventure anthropological Liberty piece, where what is essentially an Atrian anthropologist goes out into the fringe and learns more about the people who live there. So that was me getting to use my degree to create a story. But
did that start as a comic book?
Yes, it did.
And that's you started your own publishing company to do that, Travis?
Yeah.
The John Dossinger Publishing?
John Dossinger Publishing, yeah. Uh-huh. Very slow process comics. So we started the podcast after the comic was already like well in the works, and it came out before the comic.
Now, so you originally wrote for the page, I mean, at least comic books, and a lot of your influences were these great horror writers, Lovecraft and his influences. Why did you choose audio drama rather than comic books or a novel or a book of short stories?
So anything that I had written before podcasting was only ever going to be something that I wrote for me. I didn't think my writing was worthwhile until I had someone like Travis reading my scripts and telling me that I could actually put these out there and do something with them.
And we could make them.
And we could actually make them. So the reason that we chose audio drama was we had a story that could be told very well through audio. We had the know-how, and we knew that if we created it and put it out there in the podcast system, which is open to everyone to listen to, that we'd be able to get some people to actually listen to our show. And it wouldn't have fit so well for comics because we knew that we wanted something that was going to be a little bit faster to produce. And at that point, Travis had been making comics for so long and it hadn't come out yet. And I always feel like if you write a book and you put it in front of someone, you're asking them a huge favor. It's a favor of time for someone to sit down and read an entire book that you've written. But I can write the same amount of words that would go into a book in an audio drama, and people don't feel like it's as burdensome because they can listen to it in their free time, when they're driving, when they're commuting, when they're going food shopping.
I've never heard that reason for why somebody switched to audio drama. Couldn't make it easier on the people who are reviewing your work and giving you feedback.
I just want it to be accessible. It's it's easier to get it to people and into their minds if I'm going through their ears instead of their eyes.
And also, we don't have to hand each person the copy of the book.
Also true.
Were you already in contact with some of the podcasting community? I know previously you mentioned like the No Sleep podcast. They've been very helpful and influential on your work.
That was actually, we reached out to them when we were starting, and we asked if a couple people would be involved. David Cummings, the host of No Sleep, and Peter Lewis, one of the voices there. And they said yes, and we were really confused because we'd never podcasted before. I'd done a children's audio drama CD, which is kind of similar but different.
I wasn't able to find that.
It's
oh
hidden.
Oh my gosh, okay. You can find that.
But Legend of the Boar Knight. There's even a puppet show video on YouTube. But,
oh, wow.
That aside, we had no contacts really in the podcast world outside of No Sleep because they were the show that we listened to basically since the beginning of knowing each other. We started that podcast, and like these people are famous to us in the most personal way. I think it's called a parasocial relationship where you know someone really well and they've never met you. And then
audio has that effect on people.
It does.
Radio
so
does
intimate.
Too. In fact, I've read several articles on it, just the intimacy of the human voice.
Yes.
There was one article that was particularly on podcast, the relationship that the podcast creator and everybody associated with that podcast establishes with the listener, even though the listener might not know that creator personally, and in most cases doesn't. But that intimacy that I think other media doesn't really afford as efficiently as effectively.
I'd have to agree. You can get really close and in someone's skin when you're listening to them, as opposed to if you're watching them in a movie, an action movie, you're almost disappointed that they can't jump through the air while firing two pistols or something.
I always look at it as, who else in the world is literally whispering in your ear? It's usually just your family and your close friends. And we get the opportunity to do that as podcast creators because people are choosing to listen to us. So I think it creates that bridge of intimacy that otherwise doesn't exist when you're looking at a screen.
with actors instead of our words. Our words.
People rarely hear me.
Now, Travis, when I did the research for the interview, or when my research intern, who will be looking for a new job, did the research, I couldn't believe all you do and all you've accomplished. You produce, edit, and do the sound design for the Fool and Scholar podcast. That's the part we know. But you also have your own company that manages low-income rental apartments. You own and manage a publishing company, which we talked about, the John Dosinger Publishing. You're on the board of directors of a nationwide collections business, and you do a lot of work, and I know this very well, promoting your podcast through social media and conferences and supporting other people doing their own audio drama podcasts. I mean, you're very generous with your time there. So I know you and Caitlin are fans of that No Sleep podcast we talked about, but No Sleep also seems to be a good description of your work schedule. Do you ever get to bed?
I get a good 7 or 8 hours a night.
That's incredible.
I'm pretty good about that.
You're very good about getting things done.
I have this, I've started seeing a therapist and talking to try and understand myself better. And she says, I have a very functional ADHD where I will hyper-focus on many different things all the time throughout the day. And I'm always engaging fully in something different.
One at a time.
But it's 1,000 different things for like 30 seconds, 5 minutes, and then like I'll go under for like to edit for 5 hours, and then I'll like jump back out to do social media for a little bit. So I'm always 100% engaged in something.
Wow. And it's I guess based on having a little ADHD, it's good to have a multiple number of projects that you're working on at any one time in case you get a little burned out on one.
Absolutely. It's very helpful for exactly the burnout when you're like, I've been doing this for too long. Let's try something else.
Audio editing especially. That I sometimes get like a flow. Well, we talked about where it can be tedious, where you're taking out people's ums, which I tend to do. But it could also be a flow where time just seems to go by very quickly, even though it could be 5 hours of audio editing of sitting down at the computer.
When you're in it, audio editing can go by just like you said. You look up and you're like, how is it midnight? This makes no sense.
Exactly.
It was
yeah.
3 o'clock in the afternoon when I last checked. Other times it can also be grueling.
Now, I have to ask this. I know you've answered it before, but Caitlin, given your academic studies at the University of Oxford and all that you explained to me before, which I didn't understand half of it, of what you were doing as a research student, but I'm guessing you're the scholar.
I am, yes.
But Travis, you're far from a fool. How did you ever get that eponym?
It's a cute story.
Sure. You can tell it.
So for those who don't know, Travis and I are married, and we met at a comic book shop at a Halloween party. And at the Halloween party, we were playing a very large game of a game called Werewolf. And you get a card that says you're a villager or a werewolf or like a gypsy or like different types of things.
So kind of a role-playing game? Not quite like Dungeons and Dragons.
Like very simplistic, where villagers are just trying to find out who the werewolf is. Mm. But one of the cards that you can get is the card that says the Fool. So the first time I met Travis, he was playing the Fool in our game.
So I got her to notice me.
So it just stuck with us for a very long time. And when I went to the University of Oxford, I got a scholarship for my program, and I was considered a Frost Scholar because I was there due to the incredible generosity of the Frosts, who are this amazing couple in Florida. And so I was the scholar, and then he was the fool. And it just kind of worked out.
It seems that your skills and your talents definitely complement each other. I mean, Caitlin with your writing, and then Travis with the sound design and everything else you do. And it's plenty.
Thank you.
Now, let's get to The White Fall, because that's what we're going to play after the conversation. We'll play that first episode in its entirety. I read the idea came to you while you were on a trip together to Iceland. What fascinated you about Iceland? I mean, that becomes very clear in the show itself and some of your other podcasts. And what inspired you on the trip to write The White Vault?
So while I was on that trip, I was already writing some Tales from the Tower, which are Liberty scary stories. But I was having all of these other ideas because I was sitting in these like tiny hotels where the wind was like whipping by and you could see the snow just building up throughout the night.
Wow, that's a lot of the effect of the White Vault.
It was amazing. Uh-huh.
It was a very winter trip.
Yes, because we were like, oh, when can we afford to go to Iceland? The winter.
When nobody else goes.
Yes, when nobody wants to go. But it was beautiful, but I was writing these sci-fi scary stories, and I was like, I want to get this one done because I have this new idea. The entire time we were there, I was coming up with these new ideas. And honestly, it was when we were driving across these huge volcanic flats, and it was just this barren landscape of snow and wind. And then we went to the shore, and it's these, they have those black rock shores.
Oh, I've seen pictures, yes.
Yes, they're beautiful, but they're stark, and they don't care one way or another whether or not those huge waves come in and rip you out into sea.
I've seen video of that too, where there was actually a tour guide in Iceland, and he was taking pictures of people, video of people who were getting swept away and telling them how stupid they were.
Yeah. And
no one was hurt, fortunately.
Good.
They got very wet.
It's a very, seeing nature just not care, but it's beautiful, and it's not that it's trying to hurt people, and it's not that it's thinking about being malicious. It's just that it is an incredibly powerful force. And that helped me create this entire scene about where I wanted to send people. And from there, I just built on that story idea. And now we have the White Vault, which a lot of people say creates a feeling of isolation for them.
Oh, definitely.
As we were driving, roads were also getting closed.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it was...
Right behind
it was,
us.
No, that's kind of frightening. It's like the walls closing in. And
well, they were pretty much shutting down roads because you have this app on your phone when you go there and you can check the websites. And uh-huh. It's like, don't go on road one from here to here because it's closed off.
It's and just covered in snow.
As we were driving, they were closing roads behind us. But we had an amazing time. But seeing that landscape and having that horror mood because we're driving and we're listening to things like No Sleep, and then I'm writing these scary stories, and then my brain is also coming up with these new ideas. And by the time that we got back to Florida, because we were living in Florida again by that time, I wrote over 2 days, like the outline for the entire first season.
Wow. It's just kind of in a fever.
I was like, Travis, I have a great idea. I've been thinking about this since their trip. I want to get this out on paper. What do you think? And yeah.
It was really good. We changed a few small things, but we went on a couple dog walks, talked it through. It was a lot of fun.
Was that with Izo?
Yeah.
Okay.
Very famous dog. I follow you guys on social media. Now, how'd you go about making that first episode of The White Vault, ramping up on all the elements of audio drama? So you've got writing, casting, recording, editing, sound effects, music. And what were some of your models, besides No Sleep? I know that must have been a big influence for the podcast. And what were the biggest challenges? I know many people who've started from pretty much scratch, and it's kind of a little intimidating.
Well,
you have to see an audio editor for the first time, to sit down in front of a mic, to record your voice, and then if what you're writing actually translates to the audio drama medium.
We'd had 3 seasons before that, so it's a little bit easier for us. We knew a couple of actors. We'd worked with a few people.
That was Liberty.
That was Liberty. Uh-huh. This gentleman named David Ault became a fan of ours somewhere in the middle, and we were a really big fan of his because he was on No Sleep. He was one of the prominent actors, also on the Byron Chronicles.
Yes, he's on Eric Busby's.
He's Byron.
Uh-huh.
We got a message from him saying, you know, if you've got any room, I'd love to be on one of your shows. And Caitlin's just like, oh, well, this is great. Okay. We've got him and other people he'd worked on Liberty. I was like, hey, this guy from Iceland, who is, you know, a guest character on the show very briefly, he was really good to work with. He was a lot of fun to work with. Do you think maybe...
I was like, I can write an entire... Like, as soon as you said I had an Icelandic actor... When we were still in Iceland, I was like, "This is perfect. I know what I'm writing."
So it wasn't as difficult as one would think, though there were certain characters that we didn't have. Like, we needed the German person from Germany. We didn't know where we were going to find that, so we started casting and other characters as well. We had to cast. That was probably the most difficult part for us, was finding our very international cast.
Yeah. Mm. So Liberty was such a tiny show at the time.
But it allowed you to kind of get your feet wet and learn the technology.
Yeah, we learned everything. So now whenever people say they're going to go back and listen to season one of Liberty, we always caution them. We're like, that was our first show ever. If you're used to our newer shows, just go in knowing that it's a little bit rougher.
I was going to actually ask you about, of course, it wasn't that long ago. It was April of 2018 when you did your first White Vault. And this makes more sense to ask you about Liberty, but I was going to ask you, if you, when you go back and listen to that first episode, which we'll hear tonight, are there things that make you cringe and how did it evolve? But maybe it's better to ask when you listen back to those Liberty, early Liberty episodes, kind of the challenges that you were up against and what the lessons learned were.
A lot.
More than you can say.
I have no problem admitting that I am I'm a much better writer now than I was when we started, because now not only do I understand more how to write for audio drama specifically, but I also understand more how to work with episode story structure, how to make sure that I leave every episode with people wanting more, how I can have an entire arc, just normal things that I guess people learn when they go to school for writing that I never got. And
how'd you pick that up? Just through trial and error?
And watching a lot of TV.
And mediums like that are actually very formulaic in that.
Yeah.
I know they have in Hollywood whole screenwriting classes where they have the three-act format and there's a number of technical terms associated with each of the scenes and the rise and the fall and the conflict. And so those are things you just picked up naturally from trying and viewing television and movies.
Yeah, I wanted to. I mean, I don't. You say things like the three acts. I know that other people have talked to me about that before.
I'm no expert.
But yeah, I don't think about it like that. I just think about it as if I was listening to this or if I was watching something, does it have that feeling of relaxation and then tension? And when I get to the end, does it leave me thinking I've both learned something and that I have new questions? Because I'm always thinking of how I'm going to drive my story forward. So everything has to have its own plot point, its character development. And I didn't know that going in. I didn't know that starting off. I mean, I had just been writing for myself off and on, but I used to mostly just do physical medium arts. So things like cartography, which you brought up earlier. So it was a very big change for me. And I can definitely say now I've had to improve a lot more than I ever thought I was going to have to, because I never thought when we were doing Liberty it was going to grow as fast, and then I never thought when the White Vault started it was going to explode into the huge thing it is now, and I didn't think this was going to be my life, and I have to be better because I have to keep creating.
But you learned by doing.
Yeah.
now we talked about some of the things that you picked up. One thing about The White Vault is the format itself. It's told through a researcher, the narrator, and it reconstructs the events of the story through found footage. So there's audio and video recordings. There's journal entries. I know it has several advantages. It minimizes every audio drama creator has that problem of exposition. You don't want too much of a narrator, even though they did that a lot in the golden age of radio, old-time radio. A narrator, in some cases, if it wasn't written that well, would tell you almost everything that was happening, and then they would just add sound effects to almost emphasize, oh, no, don't shoot, or oh, he shot me. which is probably bad writing. Now, the other advantage is that by telling the story this way, not only kind of minimizing the use of a narrator and exposition, you also allow the listener to get into the heads of the characters. And we were talking about intimacy. This is even more intimate because you not only get the things that they say in conversation, but through journal entries and things, you'll get things that they are thinking maybe about the other characters they would never say to them out loud. Was that something you kind of arrived at right away or stumbled across?
I knew I was going into the found footage format. When you use single narrators or people who are writing journal entries to themselves, especially because in The White Vault, people are writing in their native languages and they feel more secure and private doing that. So for instance, when our Icelandic character is writing something to himself or to his family, he's writing it in Icelandic. And he knows that nobody else there is going to be able to read that. So he can be very
private. Yes,
he can be very personal, very private. And that allows you to have that intimacy with the character. It allows you to glimpse behind the curtain of their mind. But one of the other things that I both dislike and very much enjoy about narrative podcasts, or at least the use of a single monologue every once in a while, is especially in horror and in found footage, it creates the idea of an unreliable narrator.
Right. You're always getting it through the characters. You're not getting it through this third person omniscient.
So when people listen to the story, sometimes they'll hear one person's view of an event, and then they'll hear a recorded document of that event, and they'll see that there's differences because the way that one person perceives it is going to be different from the way another person perceives it or the way that it actually happened. So that's something that I get to play around with a lot with the found footage.
And was that something you arrived at right away, or was the story of the White Vault told a little different originally, and then you kind of...
No, it was always found footage, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I thought it would be an interesting way because I'm knitting a larger story together with, you said the researcher, we call her the documentarian.
Oh, okay.
And she's telling a larger story through the use of these found footage pieces. So she, to us, is a main character. And people would hear more about that as the seasons continue.
And that's really the position of the listener. You're kind of in the head of the documentarian and also trying to piece things together as you hear them through the found footage.
Yep.
Now, Travis, I talked to you a little about this early before we got behind the mics. And I mentioned in the intro that you go to great lengths to get things right and to make everything authentic. So I saw a recent post on your Patreon blog. I just want to read a little bit of it. This is about the most recent episode, season 3, episode 2 of The White Vault, which came out, about a few weeks ago? Or
1 week.
Oh, one, okay.
A week from Tuesday.
Okay.
The next one's out Tuesday.
So this is what Travis wrote. This has easily been the episode with the most difficulties that we could not have prepared for. We had to recast and re-record a lead actress in under 1 week. We flew over 10,000 miles to our live show, the Austin Film Festival, Florida, Maine, and Podtails. We pulled off a 2-hour live show. Protests in Chile, which of course you couldn't have foreseen, prevented another actress from recording safely, delaying us 2 weeks. One of our other leads was unable to record retakes until Saturday morning as he's in the middle of a 1,500-mile move because so much of the timing of this episode is specifically dependent on the voices. And I got sick on Saturday, meaning Travis got sick on Saturday. We didn't get a full sound effect cut until Sunday at 11 a.m., at which time our show's mixing engineer became violently ill. And that's not your typical episode.
Briefly I hope. Hospitalized.
Yes, I know. Everything that could go wrong seemed to go wrong. Social unrest in Chile, people getting sick, people moving 1,500 miles away.
It was a pretty intense couple weeks there, yeah. But we got through it. That was the really tough, like each one of those things though in and of itself was like show crippling. Now we have to mix the episode and we've got 12 hours. What can we do?
So now we're going to transition from that about how much trouble a podcast can be to trying to get people who are maybe listening, who have a story idea and are thinking about doing their own podcast. I ask you, because you guys, as I said before, do so much for the podcast community. Sarah Rae Werner is the same way, a girl in space. It's not just your own work that you're interested in. You're basically evangelizing the medium. And I would say, even though it's been around for about 10, 15 years, podcasts, I know Eric's goes back, I think he goes back to the early 2000s or something like that. You know, Byron Chronicles. It's still, I think, in its infancy. And we can see that as a medium. I mean, it's certainly recognized. A lot of people listen to it, but it's not as established, of course, as movies, television, certainly not as books, which go back thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. So what would you advise somebody who, say, has a story idea, kind of like Caitlin, you had in Iceland for The White Vault? How would they get started? And maybe we know some of the things that can go wrong. What are some of the things that can go right?
So the first thing I will say is, if you're thinking of writing a script and you think your story can be told through audio, is give a few things a listen and see if the way that someone is telling their story feels like it would fit the format of your idea as well. Some stories are not built for audio. Some are perfect for audio storytelling. And
how would you tell? Is there some things you could look at there?
There are, so like if you have this really great idea and it's like a motivational sports story and it relies very heavily on the action of sports, physical action doesn't translate well unless you have like a narrator like, oh, and he's breaking left.
Right.
That would basically be most of your show if you wanted to be able to tell it effectively. So action doesn't translate as well.
As dialogue, for example.
Yeah, dialogue is so much easier and more clear because confusion is the killer of a story right there.
Because you're trying to place an image in the listener's head, and you don't always have complete control of that image, but you want at least some control over what they're seeing and hearing.
And it's it goes both ways. Sometimes they'll create an image that is maybe not what you're trying to put forth, but the great thing about horror and audio is the monster someone creates in their mind is always going to be scarier than whatever monster I could have created and put on a screen somewhere. Because when people put the theater of the mind to work, it's going to create the thing that terrifies them the most. And so it kind of works both ways.
I think that works in some horror stories where they don't even show the monster.
Yes.
Or they wait till near the very end to show the monster, and they're building up that suspense. And people are saying, what can this thing look like? You know, it must be terrifying.
Yeah. Absolutely. Another thing I would say, there are resources out there. There's a Facebook group called the Audio Drama Hub, H-U-B. And if you sign up on Facebook in the group, that can be a really great resource. If you have questions, if you're looking for guidance or a specific field, like you don't have access to any sound designing stuff, people there will link you to freesound.org, which is a great resource. For sound effects, yeah. Or anything to that effect, or even other crew members to work with, or team members, or actors.
And even maybe recommendations for equipment. I know Sarah uses a very simple Yeti mic, a Blue Yeti mic. And a laptop, and even some of the software that people use. I mean, there's some very Audacity, for one, a lot of people use that. That's free.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
Open source that runs on a Mac or a PC. So, I know Sarah just recently started a Facebook group. I'm a member of it, but I forgot the name. It was like Seriously
Successful.
Seriously
Podcasters.
Successful podcasters.
Okay. We won't ask you to say that five times.
I cannot.
Yeah, and I couldn't either. I can't even say it once.
It's okay. That's why I'm not an actress.
but those resources are available for people who want to just start. And I encourage everybody to do it. It's, like I said, it's in infancy. There's no reason why you couldn't you guys have over 1 million downloads already, but the next 1 million download podcaster might be out there. And
absolutely, they are.
Yes, don't feel intimidated by it. Now, last question. I want to ask how listeners can access not just The White Fall, but your other podcasts. And since you're on Patreon, you have several pages on Patreon, how they can help support podcasts that they really like yours.
Yeah, you can find our works at 4 different websites. Sorry, they're all different.
I know. I thought there'd be one Fool and Scholar Productions website, but there's not.
No, we're in the process of building one. We haven't done that quite yet. LibertyEndures.com is our sci-fi world Liberty. It's a lot of fun. TheWhiteVault.com is the Arctic horror with a lot of cultural elements to it. VastHorizonPodcast.com is the another science fiction that we have, which is One Woman Versus the Void of Space. It's very fun. And finally, DarkDicePod.com is sort of a fantasy, started off as a Dungeons & Dragons game, but it's evolved into being more of an audio drama.
And our Patreon is actually, we'd only have one Patreon for all of our shows, and it's Fool and Scholar Productions. You can just search for Fool and Scholar Productions on Patreon, and you can see all of the bonus content. We even do bloopers, which we love, because one of the great things about audio is even our actors feel like it's very personal to them, so they feel comfortable with being funny and out of character sometimes, and it's a real hoot to hear them.
And we are completely fan supported, so thank you.
Well, thanks so much for coming in. There's so much more I could ask, but I want to make sure that we had time to play a full episode of The White Vault, and this is hopefully people will get hooked when they hear it. Caitlin Statz and Travis Vengroff, thanks so much for talking with us on the Holy Crowley Hour.
Thank you so much for having us.
We would be remiss if we didn't play you an episode of The White Vault. Might as well start at the very beginning, The White Vault Season 1, Episode 1, titled Freestead, which will be taking over your radio for the next 20 minutes as the narrator cautions, travel not advised.
Several days ago, I came into the full collection of documents and recordings that I will be presenting here. Although many of the recordings and documents are dated, some lack explanation for where they fit into the constructed timeline. Additionally, due to the multiple viewpoints present, I've taken it upon myself to edit and sort documents or recordings into appropriate points in the hope of presenting a fuller picture. This report includes the records of Dr. Rosa Della Torre, Walter Heath, Graham Kasner, Dr. Karina Schumacher-Weiss, and Jonas Thorninson during an expedition in Svalbard. The White Vault. Thank you. This recording comes from the phone of Dr. Schumacher Weiss.
Hey Mama, ich bin's. Ich soll für eine Firma, für die ich arbeite, für ein paar
Hey Mama, it's me.
One of the companies I work for needs me to go on a trip out to Svalbard for a few weeks. Well, more accurately, I hope to work for them. Apparently they received a signal from one of their outposts that may indicate some rather interesting finds. Seeing as how they've been looking to expand, I'm hoping this job will solidify in a good job for me within their geological team. Oh, my stop is coming up, Mama. I'm sorry I will miss Papa's birthday, but I ordered a gift for him and shipped it to you. Please wrap it up and give it to him at the party, okay? After all this time, in this job market, I cannot afford to pass up this opportunity. I spoke with Rolf yesterday about this. He was obviously upset, but he supported my choice to take this job. If I impressed them, I would not have to live permanently on Svalbard, as most of their geological surveys take place during the summer months. It would be rough, but the payment would certainly help us with our house payments. Honestly, Rolf is not the best at keeping secrets. I found a ring when I was cleaning. Mama, I think he will propose when I get back. Before spring, for certain. If I don't message you again, be well. I love you and I'll see you later. Pass my love on to Papa, okay? Tschüss!
Dated slightly before Dr. Schumacher Weiss's recording, Mr. Walter Heath of Reading, UK, had written in his personal journal, a collection of emails he sends to himself in the folder labelled Documentation.
I got a job. Serendipitous timing. My lease is up on the flat soon, and the company says the job will take a little less than a month, between travels, preparations, and weather conditions. I don't own too many possessions, especially after the divorce, so that's not going to be a problem. I have a few weeks to sell some things on Gumtree, I know a friend who will give me a few pounds for my old TV, and Molly took Sir Tufts in the separation anyway. Yeah. Space between this place and me would seem like a certified vacation, were it not in the ass-end frigid wastes of Svalbard. So yes, the job is in Svalbard, land of polar bears and the midnight sun. Except at this time of year, I'll be lucky to see any sun at all. It's not as though I have a tanned complexion to maintain. I'd been sending out feelers for a job for months now, but I'd not even applied for their company. Seadrift Group is some independent mining contractor out of Iceland, Norway, and Sweden. Apparently, they're hiring on short notice due to many of their general contractors occupied on winter jobs elsewhere, since apparently most people don't want to head to the dark, cold, endless night of a hungry bear-ridden glacier. I, on the other hand, have little less to do than pack up and head out. When I spoke with them on the phone, I was told I was required because of reports of an equipment malfunction. They're sending a team to an outpost to address the issue. The company is unsure what caused the signal they received, but it's more expensive to mount multiple expeditions than to send a team, including myself, out to fix or assess the transmitter. I heard rovers may be involved. And the pay is fantastic. I'll be back in Reading. No, I'll find somewhere else to let a new flat. After all this is over, there will be no need to come back here.
No other documents pertaining to their work with the Seadrift Group were found before the arrival of the team at the Seadrift Group meeting station on Svalbard in Ny-Ålesund.
Are you Mr. Kastner?
No, sorry to disappoint. I'm Walter Heath, the repair technician and IT specialist.
Sorry, Mr. Heath. I'm Jonas Thorsson. But please call me Jonas. I'm the Seadrift Group's project representative for this expedition. I hope your travels were not too difficult?
Everything was quite fine. My flight from Longyearbyen experienced some fairly frightening turbulence, though. I hope you don't mind, but I'm recording this. This is quite the adventure into the dark north.
Not at all, please. Though I don't think my voice will lend to fair listening. The flight turbulence, that is to be expected during this time of winter. It is uncommon to have flights this time of year for exactly such a reason. There's coffee on the pot if you would like some.
Oh, yes, please. I think my fingers are stuck in place. After a bout at the university, I promised myself I would never head further north than Aberdeen. how things change.
Is this the siege room?
Yes, please come in. The heat will get out. I'm Jonas Thorason. You must be Dr. Della Torre.
Yes, nice to meet you, Mr. Tomlinson.
Jonas will be fine. Please, come in, Doctor. Pour yourself a cup of coffee. We're waiting on others.
Thank you, Jonas. And Rosa will be fine. Are you also on the expedition?
Yes. Hello. Hi. I'm Walter Heath, the repair technician and IT specialist. And you, Dr. Delator, are you a geologist? Volcanologist? I don't know what Siege Group would need out there beside me in a warm overcoat.
Rosa, please. And I am a medical doctor. I've worked on Svalbard for companies before. I'm there to make sure you and the others on the expedition come back in good health, Mr. Heath.
Walter is fine.
Jonas, are you on the expedition?
Yes, I'm the Siege Group's project representative.
And that entails...
I report back on the status of outpost stations and assess the abilities of potential hires.
So you are the man to impress.
Hello? We're looking for the Siege Group.
Yes, come in. You must be Dr. Schumacher-Weiss and Mr. Kastner.
Hello.
Mr. Kastner and Dr. Schumacher-Weiss, this is Dr. Rosa Della Torre and Mr. Walter Heath. I am Jonas Thorason, the representative for Siege. Now that we're all here, I would like to begin the short presentation regarding our goal at Outpost Freestead.
Mr. Thorason. I see coffee. Is there coffee?
Please call me Jonas. And my apologies, there's coffee over there. Please make yourself comfortable while I set up the presentation.
Are you recording?
Yes, it's for my travel logs. Does it bother you?
No.
And what do you contribute to our little expedition, Mr. Kastner?
Have you ever been to Svalbard before, Mr. Heath?
Walter is fine. And no, I've never been this far north before at all.
Not many people have. I'm here to make sure you don't break down and get stuck out atop a glacier in negative 17 degrees, or get stalked by a polar bear when you go out to repair whatever it is you all need to fix.
Well, it is calming to know the company has thought so much about our safety.
Hello, everyone. As the representative of Siege Group, I would like to thank you for accepting the offered position for the examination and repair expedition out to Outpost Freestead. Siege Group knows it was a short notice, but we are appreciative and hope you find yourself in the position to aid Siege further in the future. Several weeks ago, a transmission from Outpost Freestead was received at Siege Group's primary receiving station here in Nyalasen. While we mostly operate mining contracts around Svalbard, Siege Group is also an established surveyor here and across multiple Scandinavian countries.
Excuse me, I'm not sure if I got this right. I think I heard something about polar bears?
They must be hibernating about now.
Polar bears do not hibernate.
That answers my question.
We have specialized equipment at several outposts, including Freestead, that receive input signals from several research rovers, both belonging to Siege Group and multiple other organizations who prefer to use our network than set up their own. The signal we recently received from the station was unintelligible, but more importantly, that outpost is only meant to receive and aggregate data for collection in the summer, not send messages or signals unless a malfunction or an emergency has taken place. We cannot tell what it was based on the single message received. Due to this, Siege Group has decided to send out this team to find the reason for the signal.
Wait, hold on. I was told that my expertise would be needed. This sounds more like some lost tourist stumbling across a refuge from the winter cold.
And that very well might be. But the information collected by those rovers is paramount to several geological studies being undertaken here, for several reasons across several projects. Your past work with the advancements of the use of GPR and its mining applications, as well as your recent work in Norway regarding volcanic activity, has been taken into account by our primary managers. I'm not a scientific man myself, so I apologize if I've misrepresented your work.
So I am to examine the collected data, right? I will at least require information regarding what data has been collected and what for.
Not exactly. Because of the rovers, we utilize an algorithm that takes incoming geological data to inform us of any important changes to Svalbard itself. For both glacier and seismic activity can at any point endanger the life of miners on the island. If the program detects too many outliers, it can be considered an emergency. I will have some papers available for you tomorrow when we depart. I apologize for the short notice. Being it is the winter months, many simple amenities are not fully stocked. print drink, for example.
Ah, thank you. Also, I do not see why this could not have been messaged to me earlier.
Now that we understand Dr. Schumacher-Weiss's role, Mr. Heath, or Walter, will be required to inspect and repair the transmitter for any possible damage. While Citigroup is uncertain for the reason for the signal, the cost of sending two groups at separate times is too high. One of you may be redundant, but you will be paid nonetheless. Dr. Della Torre and Mr. Kastner are assigned to get you there and back safely. I will be accompanying you in case of any damages or events that require documentation for Citigroup records. The next rover is scheduled to transfer information to the outpost 3 days from now, so we must assure the station's receiver is operational by then. Every instance of lost data...
This was the point at which Mr. Heath's recorder died. The next available document is an action report from Mr. Kastner following their arrival at Outpost Freestead.
We have successfully reached Outpost Freestead. Departure from Nyalesern was planned for 0500 with 5 fully fueled snowmobiles, 4 of which haul supplies. Due to mechanical difficulties, we did not leave Nyalesern until 525. Mr. Heath was a capable driver, contrary to previous concerns. Jonas and Dr. Schumacher-Weiss also did well. Dr. De La Torre, Rosa, had several problems with the snowmobile, only one of which warranted addressing. A belt had become shredded and was properly replaced before leaving the vicinity of Nyalesern. We traveled approximately 53 kilometers to Outpost Freestead, located just south of the border to Nordwest Spitsberger National Park. We traveled slowly and safely and made it here within 2.5 hours. We have been here for some time now, perhaps 3 hours. The outpost is a bunker. Sija Group obviously invested in these stations. We brought weeks' worth of rations with us to assure our safety and comfort, as well as restock the outpost. I spent time unloading and stocking the bunker with the goods we brought, and covered the snowmobiles for our return trip. The generator was easy to start up, even given the conditions. To the slight disappointment of Dr. De La Torre, there was no injured tourist here upon our arrival. She has since taken to starting the internal appliances. She also helped put away goods in the auxiliary bunker a few meters from the primary station. She's quite helpful and sympathetically. No one will accuse me of not keeping thorough notes regarding this expedition. The bunker is operational. I did not understand Mr. Heath, but apparently something is broken and it looks like vandalism. It will take some time to repair the damage, but he believes he is capable. Dr. Schumacher-Weiss, Karina, I think it is upset that there may be little for her to do, but is finding some of the previously stored data here regarding the geological something of the area to be rather interesting. Looks like a storm is coming.
The next recording came from the station's computer. As part of the relay and radio built into the outpost, a recording function is available at all times. Mr. Heath made use of this promptly.
That storm blew in fast.
Weather can change very quickly here. It's best not to be caught unaware.
I've got it working.
What?
The recorder in the computer.
Hey.
The radio setup here is rather advanced as well.
Do you record often, Walter?
I like to. Keeps me honest. Enough. I packed a camcorder as well.
We are well stocked. Between rations left here from the summer expeditions and the reserves we brought in, we can wait the storm out.
I even saw alcohol.
Welcome to the North.
I think it is universal.
What was that?
A polar bear.
They come in this far from the coast?
They can, though it may not be common.
Is it safe to work on the equipment? Tomorrow, that is, after the storm dies down.
Yes.
So you think it'll leave, the bear?
Eventually.
You seem very sure about this.
Don't feel confident in your ability to patch up a bear attack, Doc?
Oh, I can. And I think Walter would look all the better with his scars for it.
What? Oh, preferably not.
It won't come so close.
Once out of the populated areas, all groups must carry weapons to further their safety precautions.
You will shoot the bear, Mr. Kastner?
Well, first I'll shoot around the bear. But if it gets too close, yes. A warning shot will scare them off most of the time.
So, how long do you believe the repairs will take you, Walter?
The repairs outside? Not too long, a couple of days at most if I can get my hands to stop shaking. I'm more concerned with the internal problems.
Is there something broken with the computer?
Well, not precisely. While it looks like the transmitter-receiver tower outside was manually and rather coarsely disconnected, the computer itself, which acts as an interface for the data both incoming and outgoing, has some obviously malicious coding.
A computer error?
No. Coding is difficult. It was intentional.
So, a virus?
Maybe. I'll be examining it later after I fix the physical damage.
Any idea what it does?
I think it's what sent out the message.
So, someone intentionally damaged Citigroup property and altered some computer thing?
Seemingly so.
Thank you. This will make a difference regarding insurance claims. Please document the evidence you need to help prove this to be true. It will be valuable for my work.
So I saw something that looked like a bottle of cheap tequila earlier.
That was a bottle of aquavit. Still cheap, though.
Until the storm settles down, I don't see much work happening.
What are you looking for, Jonas?
Glasses.
The following letter was taken from the notepad of Dr. Della Torre, though the page had been torn out. Her handwriting, though legible, is disordered and unpunctuated. Given the content of the letter, I believe she was intoxicated.
Aquavit sabe de asco. Aquavit is a disgusting drink. It burns like vodka, but tastes like something you would expect from our people who enjoy pickled fishes. I've been to Svalbard enough to know it will rear its ugly head at some point or another. I miss chiles and nogada, mama's mole tamales. I'd fight for fresh fruits. Still, dill, alcohol, pickled fishes, and repugnant cheese endure. Which, as it turns out, was one of the jarred foodstuffs we were lucky enough to open tonight. Pickled fish, a tin of mashed potatoes the size of my head, and another of cut carrots. Not what I would have hoped for, but what I had expected. Jonas poured ample drink for us all. Walter was a surprisingly heavy drinker until he fell asleep at the computer desk. Karina as well. I could not stand the taste of it. Some kind of potato thing it is. Karina sipped it as the Graham. Karina is a talker when drunk. Apparently she was some geology prodigy who lost some big job. But she won't stop going on about a soon-to-be fiancé back home. It is difficult to understand her when she starts speaking in a jumble of English and German. And she snores. Jonas showed us pictures of his kids. Twin girls. Blondest hair I've ever seen. Tiny traditional Icelandic sweaters. Cute. Graham and I are up late. He's interesting. Lots of stories from travels across the north. I think he'd like tequila. Shit, it's late.
As far as I could discern, no other documentation or recordings were taken during the first day of the expedition. This completes the first collection of information regarding the repair team at Outpost Freestead. The White Vault.
You're listening to the Holy Crowley Hour on KBOO Portland, the radio show that's still trying to arrange a meeting with the head of the Ukrainian public broadcasting system. We just heard the first episode of the White Vault podcast titled Freestead from our guests tonight, Caitlin Statz and Travis Van Groff of Fool and Scholar Productions. We should mention that Travis and Caitlin will be speaking at PodFest 2020, which takes place March 6th through the 8th in Orlando. There'll be a special track this year on audio drama podcasts like The White Vault. Well, that's all for this episode of the Holy Crowley Hour. If there's even the slightest possibility you like what you heard tonight, you can tune in every fourth Monday of the month from 11 p.m. to midnight, and you can stream and download previous episodes from our Holy Crowley Hour page on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. A big Thanksgiving thank you to our guests tonight, Caitlin Statz and Travis Vengroff of Fool and Scholar Productions. Also, big thanks to Crowley Cult member emeritus Jason Harder and to Jeff Henderson for engineering tonight's show. I'm your host, Ken Jones, saying see you all again next month for our Christmas Eve extravaganza on Monday, December 23rd, 2019 at 11 p.m. In the meantime, I'll be heading outside the KBOO studios to catch a ride back to Carl Crowley headquarters in Beaverton. We'll be getting ready for our traditional Thanksgiving Day meal, a carne asada burrito from Rico's Tacos, a French dip sandwich from Beaverton Substation, a slice of Detroit-style pizza from Ex Novo, and a wet dish rag, a chicken parmesan sub from Jersey Mike's. Beaverton is truly the culinary capital of the Pacific Northwest. Well, good night, everyone. Joe Woods coming up next with Faraway Places, or as we like to call it, Quid Pro Joe. Apologies to the Republican National Committee who used the pun first, though with much more evil intent.